Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is just fed up with AIG bonuses.
It makes me angry. I slammed the phone more than a few times on discussing AIG. It's just absolutely, I understand why the American people are angry.
That's it. Just slam those phones down, Mr. Chairman. We can do it together, everybody. Slam your phone down. We're going to make it. We are the world. We are the chairman on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 16th. I'm John Hockenberry. We are the chairman, Farai.
Yeah, I feel like that. I'm in a chair. At least I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji, out spending time with her new child. Coming up this hour, we've got your takeaway agenda. It's the weekly cheat sheet for what to watch in the news. Plus, we've got an alarming new report that shows a major American city with AIDS rates rivaling Africa. All this and much more ahead, but first these headlines.
Protesters in Pakistan are getting what they want. The government says it will rehire judges fired by former leader Pervez Musharraf. Here's opposition spokesman Sadiq Al-Farouk.
We are satisfied with this because it is the first example in Pakistan that a judiciary dismissed by a dictator has been reinstated. Our leader, Mr. Nawaz Sharif, after consulting the liar leaders, has dismissed the Long March.
Mass demonstrations went on for days. Lawyers and political activists clashed with riot police who tried to shut the marchers down. Cops arrested hundreds. Now the prime minister says they'll be set free. We'll go to Pakistan for analysis a little later at what appears to be a much weakened civilian government. A volatile day for Pakistan and neighboring Afghanistan. Militants in Pakistan's northwest frontier province hit a convoy carrying supplies for U.S. and NATO troops. In southern Afghanistan, at least 11 are dead after a suicide blast.
And the Fed chief Ben Bernanke says the recession will be over this year. He also told 60 Minutes in a rare interview that a recovery could start next year. He says times are tougher now, but the risk of a full-scale depression is past. And President Obama will launch a new program for small businesses later this morning. He's tapping into the stimulus package to beef up loan aid to small companies.
More possibly frustrating information from AIG. The insurance giant is revealing what outside companies got tens of billions in government bailout funds. Oil prices are sinking at times below $44 a barrel, and March Madness is here. The field is now set for college basketball's championship tournament. It starts this week. The top men's seeds are Connecticut, Pittsburgh, North Carolina, and Louisville. The women's bracket comes out tonight, and because of the recession, they say they're going to try to put the brackets close together so teams don't have to travel and spend so much money.
It's amazing.
S&P and Dow gained a bit on Friday, nearly 1%. The Dow begins trading at 7223. The S&P starts at 756. Futures trading suggests a positive to flat opening. Sad news today, Seattle losing the Post-Intelligencer. One of the dailies goes down. But is this a sad story? Tell us what your morning newspaper means to you. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The trouble for newspapers in a time when much journalistic content is available free online.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and Farai Chidea is here for Adora Udoji.
Hello.
It is, of course, Monday morning.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done. What's going on?
What's going on? What's going on?
Monday morning, we look at the agenda. We're looking at what's getting tested, what policies and debates are headed for some decisive critical stage this week, and what's going to be driving the global headlines in the days ahead. Joining us is our friend Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times. He's in the studio with us. And I think, Marcus, it's a week of taking stock, perhaps claiming some credit for a little positive economic news. And the rising profile of Pakistan certainly makes for an interesting mix. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
Let's talk, first of all, about the rally that happened last week. I suspect that this week government agencies, and particularly the Treasury and the administration, are going to try to position themselves to take credit for what seemed like a very positive end of the week. How's that going to work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think we saw it over the weekend. Everyone was out there. We saw Bernanke out there in 60 Minutes, which was a pretty unprecedented appearance by a sitting Fed chief. They are trying to instill confidence. That's been their signal. That's what they really were doing last weekend. They are very aware of the fact that, you know, if you live by the market, you die by the market. Mm-hmm. They're not counting on an up market this week. They're counting on, in fact, because of AIG and all the other issues that are out there, in fact, increasing turmoil this week in the markets and probably a down market.
The numbers this week, are any of them going to help the administration making its case that there is a plan in place? We've got Tuesday and Wednesday the inflation report. We've got producer price index, consumer price index, jobless claims on Thursday, of course. What's likely to help the administration and what's likely to hurt it? Housing starts on Tuesday.
Well, this is great. Well, we're going to see these numbers, and you know, with these numbers, we'll see, are we on a deflationary spiral? Are prices still going down? Or, in fact, is there some inflation? And in this case, if we actually see prices stop decreasing, it's actually a positive sign for the economy. It means we don't have to worry so much about a deflationary spiral where prices keep going down, and then companies, because they can't raise their prices, keep laying workers off. And then that leads to further price declines because, again, more people are out of work. So actually that'll be a positive, but we don't know what those numbers are going to hold. The question is going to be how bad they are. They probably will not be actually good numbers in any of these categories, but the interesting thing to watch is going to be to see how bad they are, because that's what the administration is trying to do. They're trying to walk this line and saying, on the one hand, things are horrible, everything's going to hell in the handbasket. On the other hand, there's reasons for confidence. Our plans are starting to work, and they're going to keep walking that line this week, and it's going to be interesting to see how they do that with these
positioning numbers. Themselves to look like they're driving rather than just being reactive, right?
Yeah, and speaking of being proactive, how important, we've been talking a lot on The Takeaway about the psychology of the numbers game, and do you think that the psychology of simply saying, yes, the recession is ending this year and, you know, happy days, we'll be here again, will there be a psychological impact that will push forward from the Fed chair?
Well, you know, it's not going to be enough, and I think what we're going to see is more concrete details this week. For instance, as soon as today, we're going to see the White House coming out and saying there's a $5 billion credit facility they're making available to small businesses, so it doesn't look like they're just helping Wall Street. And so they're hoping that will instill confidence and make people start to believe that credit markets are still functioning, for instance.
Well, one tangible thing, I mean, it's unclear if $5 billion credit for small business is going to outbalance the anger people had for what AI. What emerged from AIG over the weekend. Here's Bonnie Frank.
With AIG, I would just say we need to find out, one, are they legally recoverable? We can't just violate law, legal obligations. I understand that. But I do want to find out at what point these legal obligations were incurred. Who said at what point we're going to give these bonuses no matter what? And I do think it's inappropriate for those people to stay in power at that company.
AIG will grant bonuses under contractual obligations, and the U.S. has to pay. That's Congressman Barney Frank expressing outrage. I'm telling you, my wife came close to picking up the pitchfork this weekend. She was ranting and raving about this all weekend. What's the administration to do to not feel as though they're in bed with AIG and are helping out these rich people?
Well, you know, this you got to feel slimy, right, in this case, and there's not much that they can do. I mean, as Chairman Frank was saying, if these things are legally recoverable, then let's recover them. If these bonuses are not legally recoverable, let's find out why not. You know, that's great to say, but we can expect a lot more political machinations this week, and there will be great foment because there is great anger in the land. We can expect lots of political machinations this week. There is on Wednesday, there's going to be a House subcommittee meeting, financial subcommittee on insurance, of course, AIG, the world's largest insurer, and the credit default swaps. It's kind of insurance based on whether bonds move up or down.
Sure.
The credit AIG actually was so linked to the global economy, banks, governments, state governments all around the world, That's why the federal government has given them, you know, $170 billion in bailouts so far. Unfortunately, there's not a lot they can do about this. We can see these political machinations, but we cannot expect a lot of real change this week. And I don't think a lot of that bonus money will be coming back.
Well, this contract law, this notion that we can't violate contracts because we live in a nation that is, ruled by laws, the notion of rule of law gets a little fuzzy when you talk about Guantanamo. On the front page of the New York Times, European leaders are getting together to talk about quid pro quos as how to close Guantanamo. And there's a question of international law and also cooperation. How is that going to play out?
Well, this is one of the fulcrums of one of the promises that President Obama made during the campaign, was that he would close down Guantanamo, the detention center there of terror suspects, within a year. Now, the problem is, what do you do with them once you close it down? There are several different categories of detainees, and about 60 of the 200-and-something there right now are actually considered not to be dangerous and actually able to extradite to other countries. The problem is some of them would face persecution if they were to go back to their own countries, mostly in Arab lands. The question is, will the Europeans take them? This is the first round of what's going to be a series of probably very complex talks between the administration and the Europeans over who will you take, under what circumstances, and most importantly, what will American intelligence agencies tell the Europeans about the candidates to relocate citizens for their different countries. The Europeans are going to see that the Americans are going to take some of those detainees ourselves.
There is certainly a lot of scrutiny among the Arab world and the Middle East over Guantanamo and over some of the maneuvers that the U.S. has made around what we call the war on terror. But there's also the question of what's actually going on in what we broadly call the Arab world. News this week coming from Pakistan, which is in continuing political turmoil. Those are supporters of Pakistani opposition leader Nawaz Sharif, who was put under house arrest on Sunday. Protesters plan a march on the Capitol to demand the reinstatement of sacked former Supreme Court Judge Iftar Chaudhry. Now he's been reinstated. So what can we expect ahead in Pakistan?
You know, Pakistan is without a doubt the greatest foreign policy challenge facing this administration, which can seem surprising given the fact that, you know, we have the largest majority of our troops right now in Iraq.
But, Marcus, it seems like this week Pakistan begins to drive that agenda. The administration isn't really able to say, we're running it. It seems like the profile is emerging that Pakistan is driving the foreign agenda in South Asia, including Afghanistan.
No question about it, John. I mean, Afghanistan, progress is not being made in Afghanistan. And the president was clear on this before, he was actually inaugurated. Progress cannot be made in Afghanistan until you have Pakistan under control. But the problem is, in Pakistan, what we've seen with this phenomenal reversal by Pakistani leadership is that they're not in control of the agenda. So the problem is, without them being in control, it's not clear who's driving that train at this point, whether it's them or the opposition.
You know, for years we've heard G8, G7, now there's G20. I've always wondered what the G stood for. I think it stands for guilty. All of the positioning and posturing that's going into the meeting that's coming up in the UK in April, there was a meeting over the weekend. What can the G20 group of guilty, emerging, rich nations who hold all the wealth in the world, what can they possibly do to drive events? It seems like they're less and less drivers and much more reactive here.
Well, you know what we saw from the G20 this week, and together they can control these foreign ministers and central bank chiefs who were there over the weekend outside London, control 85% of the global economy. We're living in a horrible economic downturn that is global, that we're probably likely to see the first decrease in global growth and certainly in global trade in 80 years, which is significant. So these guys are all trying to stay ahead of this thing. This is huge. It's magnificent. It's not clear what they can do, but right now they're trying to work on two different tracks. They're saying, number one, we're going to increase stimulus plans around the world, and number two, we're also going to fix the financial architecture, but it's not clear whether the Americans or the Europeans win, and the Americans want the stimulus first, the Europeans want the architecture.
And to do it without looking completely impotent and have no influence whatsoever, my guest was Marcus Mabry. And hey, we didn't even have time to talk about the big story of the week, and that is the last episode of Battlestar Galactica. Marcus, I know you're a huge fan. Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for our partners, The New York Times, and that's the agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So sad news in the city of Seattle. Newspapers disappearing. The Post Intelligencer.
I just wanted to say that I'm sad to see it go because while the Seattle Times has the name Seattle in it, it feels much more like a suburban daily newspaper rather than the PI, which seemed to focus more closely on the residents of the city itself.
It's a story for cities all around the country, newspapers saying goodbye in the midst of an environment where there are pressures both in terms of cost and in terms of the Internet. Tell us what you'll miss most about your newspaper at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Why have a newspaper in this era of free online media, Fry?
Well, you know, on The Takeaway, we've talked a lot about the drug cartels of Mexico, but a drug problem in West Africa is turning Guinea-Bissau into a narco state. The country is the world's fifth poorest nation, and it also plays host to an entirely different scene. Its streets are lined with Italian sports cars. Its bars are filled with guests with a taste for expensive liquor, all because it's one of the main hubs for the cocaine market in Europe. Ed Vulliame reports for The Observer, the UK-based paper. He's just written a three-part series on the drug trade, and the most recent one looked at Guinea-Bissau. Ed, it's great to have you on. And
good morning.
It's Guinea-Bissau, located south of Senegal on the west coast of Africa. There's a lot of little islands. It reminds me of, you know, maybe Florida in the Miami Vice days. How did this, you know, unassuming country in some ways get involved in the cocaine trade?
It came about due to sort of innate corruption but also because it, for really geographical reasons. I mean, you mentioned Mexico. The fact that 90% of the cocaine consumed in the U.S. comes from Mexico is partly to do with clampdowns in the Caribbean. The same clampdown sent the European supply routes to the West African coasts that were literally the shortest transatlantic crossings from South America. You can get to Guinea-Bissau in four nights, staying still by day by ship, or you can fly with one fueling stop. And so the Guinea-Bissau has become the entrepôt, along with other West African countries, but it's the worst case, for almost all the cocaine coming in thence through either Spain or the old tried and tested Italian routes into Europe. Yes, and thanks for calling it a narco state. That's what it's become. There are all these fancy terms like failed state and things. Guinea-Bissau is now run for and effectively by the narco cartels, and the recent assassinations of the president, President Vieira, and General Tanganawaye there are tribal spins on it, as there might well be, but I see these very much showing all the signs of a narco war, either intra-Colombian or between Colombians and Asian cartels trying to get in on the same patch.
Well, then, how close is Mexico, which is the other subject of your series, to being a full-fledged, full-stop narco state? I mean, the clampdown is what we're told explains the violence in the border areas in Tijuana and Juarez. But if Mexico is a narco state, that's pretty disturbing south of our border.
Well, absolutely. And I think that this is, I mean, obviously, they're two very different discourses. One is at West Africa. One is, over the Rio Grande, 20 minutes walk from El Paso. But the situation is the same in each as regards the people. If you talk about Tijuana, Juarez and so on, I mean, one of the things, these are always seen as stories. This is partly what a book I'm writing is about. Rightly or wrongly, as, cartels fighting for supply routes to the United States and Europe. where our priorities are. But that's not right, because where the river flows through, people will drink. So that, like Guinea-Bissau, cities like Tijuana, Juarez are now blighted by domestic addiction. I mean, in Tijuana, Juarez, these have been going on for quite a long time. But in Guinea-Bissau, only 3 years ago, Coke started getting washed ashore, and they were lining soccer pitches with it, and they were putting it on crops, which then died. They were so naive. They're less naive now. They're smoking the stuff as crack, or pedra, as they call it there. Mexico's the same. Mexico's not a narco state in the same way. Obviously, it's much more complex. You have the cartels waging a war on Mexican society while being integral to the Mexican economy, if you like. Whereas in Guinea-Bissau, they simply run the show. There is no President Calderon sending the army in against the cartels. The army protect the planes coming from Colombia. So Mexico is not a narco state. But the point I wanted to make, is that these places are themselves blighted by drugs. And you know, Tijuana, Juarez, Guinea-Bissau, generations are being lost to crack and crystal meth in these places. This is the tragedy which has to be added to our discourse on the smuggling on how it affects you in the United States or us in Europe as entrepôt.
What I was going to say is just, what about the moral calculations here? I mean, there's been plenty written about drug use from more of a cultural perspective in the U.S., and I'm thinking of Bret Easton Ellis and the, what is it, Bolivian marching powder? Is that what it's called in the first line of his novel? And so there's this sort of pop culty side to how people think about drugs, and then there's the cost to human beings in the West, and then there's the cost to people in the global South. How do we reconcile those? What's happening between right. the consumption and the production?
Well, this is right on the button. the thing is that we like to think of these things in the setting of great big cartels fighting like armies for the plazas, as the Mexicans call it, coming into the United States or wherever. But that's just the staging. Actually, the most vicious violence in Mexico, for sure, northern Mexico, and now in Guinea-Bissau, it seems, is about to happen, is small. The narcotraficantes, they work like any other multinational corporation. They outsource the dirty work. They don't do it themselves. Most of the most vicious violence is between little street gangs fighting for little plazas for the what in the terms of any business would be called the outsourcing or the tender, the subcontract. This is where the violence starts, and then it starts getting paid in, the tender is paid in kind, in cocaine itself. Here's the moral point. We live in this society that's trying to get all touchy-feely about where the coffee bean for your frappuccino comes from, or whether your mange tout peas are fairly traded or ethically grown. For some reason, as you rightly say, the snorting coke is exempt from this discourse. It's got this kind of celebrity glitz, as you rightly alluded to. Part of the propulsion behind this book I'm writing is, why is that? It's a very strange sort of double-faced twist. The imploding economies of these countries, the corruption of these countries, and the sheer human trash created by the river of drugs coming through, not to the U.S. or to Europe. That's a matter for them to deal with. But through these places, how many lives of cocaine did that line cost when it went up your nose? It's a question we don't ask.
Ed, we have to wrap it up here, but a great question. How many lives did that line cost? Ed Vulayami of The Observer in the U.K.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Is the civilian president of Pakistan the least popular individual in that country? We'll find out in a moment, right after headlines from Femi Okeng.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 27 minutes to the top of the hour. The insurance giant AIG has released names of outside financial institutions that benefited from the company's multiple government bailouts. AIG used government funds to make payments totaling almost $100 billion to outside firms. Peter Morisi, who's the business professor at the University of Maryland, says that AIG is behaving unethically.
What we've seen here over and over again with AIG is them gaming the Treasury, whether it's Paulson's Treasury or Geithner's Treasury. Hasn't the Treasury figured out that AIG is run by a group of scoundrels?
AIG disclosed Sunday that two-thirds of its federal aid has been paid to trading partners, and some of the recipients included firms working on some of its riskiest assets. The former Vice President Dick Cheney says that the Obama administration's reversal of Bush policies make Americans more vulnerable to new terror attacks. He's also defending the Bush administration's activities at Guantanamo Bay as being legitimate. President Obama plans to shut the detention camp down.
Cheney is like doing "I told you so" before something happens. It's a little goofy. I don't know.
In international news, moving on, El Salvador has elected a new president, its first leftist president. The Conservative Party has conceded defeat, ending some two decades of conservative rule in the Central American country. The victory is the latest in a string of leftist wins in Latin America. So do you think that that bid we have in for Dick Cheney, will we get him on the show?
We'll get him. I think we'll get him. Yeah, we'll get him tomorrow, for sure.
You called him goofy.
Yeah.
That'll just be the clincher.
Why do you say "I told you so," you know, for something awful happening like that, even when it does? It drives me crazy. Anyway, more about Pakistan. The Pakistani government agreed early this morning to reinstate the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's a stunning concession, and it's an example of brinkmanship going on between Nawaz Sharif, the opposition leader, who is heading toward the capital in a convoy threatening to stage a mass protest, and the civilian government and the Pakistani military, who all appear very threatened by this domestic unrest. Ben Arnoldi, South Asia Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, joins us from Islamabad. Ben, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we already have seen that this dispute over the between the judiciary and the government in Pakistan brought down Pervez Musharraf. It appears as though a similar set of issues has produced a constitutional crisis in Pakistan one more time. First of all, what is the implication likely to be of Mr. Chaudhry now being reinstated at the Supreme Court?
Well, Pakistan has always suffered from rulers who try to grab too much power, whether they're military rulers like General Pervez Musharraf or the civilian ruler, the current man, Zardari. And the reason why this is so important to Pakistanis is for once there's finally some check on that person's power, that if you have an independent judiciary, they can curb some of the decisions that are made by the rulers. And so there's hope that this particular decision might go some direction towards fixing this constitutional crisis.
Is there any explicit sense that Chaudhry plans immediately to embark on a series of decisions or legal opinions that might curtail the power of President Zardari or the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Ashfaq Parvez Kiani?
That's unknown, but he obviously was deposed under Pervez Musharraf because he was making decisions and looking into cases that were threatening to the government. And one of the reasons why President Zardari has been not interested in restoring the Chief Justice is that there are cases pending against him that he worries might be reopened. And so that's a possibility, but we just have to wait and see.
You know, one analyst we spoke with last week suggested that President Zardari has really mishandled the domestic agenda here by focusing on Afghanistan, the incoming Obama administration, and the crisis over the attacks in Mumbai in India last November to the exclusion of domestic politics, and that he's suffering for it right now. Do you believe that?
I'm shocked how unpopular he is here. I mean, there are many people who have voted for the current ruling People's Party, mostly because they really admired Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated. Now, even those voters, I talked to many, many who say, I just really do not like Zardari, and are now more interested in voting for his opponent, Nawaz Sharif. And there's a general perception on the street here that America will just support a Pakistani ruler who's easy to manipulate, not who is popular with the people. And so one of the things that I heard a lot in the celebrations today is that ordinary Pakistanis think that this people power movement might result in their leaders listening more to them than to Washington. Now, analysts I talk to are sort of skeptical about that, but that's at least the hope among ordinary Pakistanis.
When you say people power, what is it that people want? I mean, when you say people want change, that can be vague in countries from El Salvador to the U.S. So how would you sum up the needs of the Pakistani people when they think of what they need from government?
This is going to sound kind of like a strange civics lesson in terminology, but they want things like balance of powers and checks and balances. I mean, things that, like, James Madison talked about in the founding of our country, and they really do say those things. I watched a group of young men last night. It was 3 a.m. They were up at the Chief Justice's house, and they were gathered, and they were jumping up and down, chanting, "Rule of law, rule of law." And I just thought, wow, you know, I would never see that kind of scene in the United States, but there's an understanding here that really the foundation for democracy isn't just having an election every now and then. It's having institutions that can put checks on rulers who don't listen to people. And that's really what they want.
That's an odd contradiction, because a diluted sense of checks and balances also would deny a very charismatic leader who, as you say, would be able to put a face to the United States and not be so manipulated. It's a bit of a tough trade-off.
Yeah, it is, although there's a sense that if the ruler is not popular among the people, that they might look towards a big country like the United States to kind of prop them up.
Ben Arnoldi, South Asia Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Tough going there in Islamabad as Pakistan goes through civil unrest that's continuing. It looks like the opposition did not blink.
Absolutely. And John, all this morning we're talking about the fate of your newspaper. We got Nathaniel, who emailed us from Detroit. His city is going to a 3-day-per-week home delivery with digital editions available 7 days. He adds, "Needless to say, our household is very unhappy." So we're asking you, what does your morning paper mean to you? Do you miss it if you've lost it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. War tests soldiers, generals, and nations. The battlefield, it is said, takes the measure of courage and valor. Our military medals and ribbons are all about courage and valor. But there are other tests in wartime that carry no medals, moral tests. This curious and often barbaric trade-off between some military necessity and raw, animalistic revenge. One such test was first reported 40 years ago today. It began simply enough with two American soldiers having a drink in a bar in Vietnam. Ron Reidenauer listened as his friend told him of horrific events on the afternoon of March 16, 1968, in a village called My Lai.
We sat down to have a beer, and after a few minutes he says, "Hey man, did you hear what we did at Pinkville?" Which is what we called My Lai at the time. And I said, "No, what'd you do at Pinkville?" He said, "Well, we went in there and we killed all these people, this whole village."
Soldier Reidenauer couldn't believe what he'd heard, and he started tracking down other men who'd been at My Lai. A year later, he wrote a letter to President Nixon and other high-ranking government officials and said U.S. troops were responsible for a brutal massacre in the village. Around that same time, a reporter named Seymour Hersh got a tip from an anti-war lawyer. The lawyer said a U.S. Army general named William Calley was being charged with the murder of 109 Vietnamese at My Lai. Hirsch spent an entire day racing around Army bases in South Carolina until he finally found Calley.
When he came in to the barracks, I was waiting for him, and I said, "Are you Calley? I'm Hirsch." He said, "Oh, yeah, my lawyer said you'd look me up as if I found them so easily." This is 12, 13 hours of looking. And then he told me his story and pretended to be very cocky and calm. But at one point, it must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, we were drinking beer, and he went to the bathroom, and he left the door open and had a mirror in it. And I saw he vomited bright red arterial blood, which I knew then he had an ulcer probably as big as a quarter or half dollar. And it was a pose.
Hirsch broke the story in the New York Times, and the nation began to look into its heart and soul about the nature of war and what had happened at this place called My Lai. William Calley was court-martialed in 1971. He offered the judge this defense.
"The only crime that I have committed is in judgment of my values. Apparently, I valued my troops' lives more than I did that of the enemy."
Calley was found guilty on 22 counts of premeditated murder. Calley's fellow commanding officer, Ernest Medina, was also court-martialed. He offered this defense.
"I think the verdict of guilty must be shared by not only the members of the jury as members of the armed forces, but everybody in the United States."
No apology. Instead, collective blame for the rape, murder, and torture at My Lai. Ernest Medina was found not guilty, and William Calley served only 3.5 years under house arrest before being released by a federal judge. 30 years after the massacre, Defense Secretary William Cohen had this to say, March 16, 1998.
"I believe by virtue of the training, the discipline, the exercise of leadership on the part of our military leaders, that is very unlikely to occur in the future."
So did we pass the test? Did these soldiers fail it, this moral distinction between combat and murder? 5 years before the war in Iraq, the Secretary of Defense could not have foreseen incidents of murder and torture at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay or Haditha. Or could he? What was the test 40 years ago at My Lai? What is it today?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A report on a public health crisis in the shadow of the U.S. Capitol and the White House coming up right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke says that the economy could start recovery as early as next year. He says this hinges on the government's ability to get banks lending again, all while stabilizing the larger financial system. Beginning today, food labels on most fresh meat and some produce must list where the food comes from. This is a new policy was enacted by Congress last year. In international news, the trial of an Austrian man accused of imprisoning and abusing his daughter for decades is underway. He's on trial for a range of charges, including murder, rape, and enslavement. He pleaded guilty to incest but says he's innocent of murder. And North Korea is letting a group of stranded South Koreans go home. The North partially opened a border crossing to let the workers go back home. And a small number of South Korean citizens work at an industrial zone in the north. Workers there were trapped since Friday when Pyongyang shut the border crossing without explanation. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks so much, Femi. And a new report funded by the Center for Disease Control is putting into light some very grim statistics. There was some good news, actually, about AIDS in Africa when President George W. Bush toured the continent in 2003.
The approach has reduced the HIV infection rate to 5% in this country, the most dramatic decline in the world. For men in Uganda, the value of this achievement is beyond measure. Men and women are gaining years of life. More Ugandan children are growing up with mothers and fathers. and this country is reclaiming its future.
That was George W. Bush from 5 years ago, but is our nation today reclaiming its future when it comes to HIV and AIDS? There's a new report from the CDC that says 3% of people in Washington, D.C. have HIV. The rate of infection of HIV/AIDS is three times the level considered an epidemic, higher than many West African countries. For some perspective, we've got Jose Antonio Vargas, a reporter for The Washington Post. His 2006 series on AIDS is subject of a forthcoming documentary, The Other City. We've also got Dr. Helene Gayle, the president and CEO of CARE. She spent 20 years at the CDC earlier in her career, and I want to thank you both for coming on The Takeaway. I'm going to jump right in here. Jose, why did the rate of HIV and AIDS rise 22% from 2006?
A lot of that is actually because of the reporting. I spent a year basically trying to get to know the bureaucracy that was, that is the AIDS office. And in many ways, it was an incredibly dysfunctional office. It has 12 directors in the past 23 years. Dr. Hayter, who's now the director of the AIDS office, is the third in the last five. And so what's interesting about that is for the first time, they actually have enough staff to accurately count the surveillance data that they had. So this 22% increase is because they're cleaning up the data and they've found new HIV and AIDS cases. That's really the result of that.
What are we getting a sense of in terms of transmission? Is this, same-sex, heterosexual sex?
That is really what's unique about the epidemic in the city. You know, one of the things that actually Dr. Hayter told us, and, you know, this was a pretty long story that was in the paper yesterday, and it could not have had a bigger headline, at least here in Washington. One of the things that we didn't even make into the story is that Dr. Hayter said that D.C. probably has the most complex epidemic in the country. And what makes it really complex is that we have three modes of transmission happening all at once. Men to men, men sleeping with men, which as the CDC calls it, IDU, which is intravenous drug users, and heterosexual contact. And that makes it unique. If you go to San Francisco, for example, it's a much more MSM disease. New York, much more MSM and IDU disease. Baltimore, definitely IDU disease. Here in San Francisco, for the most part, here in D.C., for the most part, we have those three modes of transmission.
Dr. Gayle, when you hear about Washington, D.C., is this a cautionary tale of what will happen soon in other places, or is this a very specific outlier?
Well, in some ways it's both. I think, as Jose said, the epidemic and the factors driving the epidemic in D.C. Are perhaps a little bit unique, and it is a much more comprehensive epidemic, if you will, because it really does touch on all three of the major modes of transmission. On the other hand, there are other cities that have AIDS rates as high as D.C., particularly urban areas like New York, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, which have rates that are just behind Washington, D.C. So I think it does tell us that we've got to look a little bit closer at some of the urban areas that may have mm-hmm. some of the same yep. Dynamics going on, because while D.C. may be, at one end of the spectrum, it isn't as if it is the only place where our neglect, lack of coordinated approach, lack of vigorated response has meant that there are other populations in this nation that are not too far behind.
Dr. Gayle, is this a matter of public education, the pendulum sort of swinging away from awareness, or is it more a matter of urban areas do not have a public health infrastructure capable of tracking something as complex as this, and D.C. is sort of the first casualty?
Well, again, I think it's both. You know, we know that education is a prerequisite, and keeping this on people's minds, making sure that the public is aware of the risk and recognize that each generation we have to do prevention. We can't say we educated and gave the tools for one generation, rates went down, let's pack our bags and go home. So part of it is the education and awareness, but it's much broader than that. It is having a comprehensive response that includes knowing your statistics and your data, like Jose mentioned, has been a problem with D.C. It's being able to have a surveillance system. You know, you can't fly a plane if you don't have directions. You know, you have to have some sort of a blueprint and baseline to let you know where you're starting from, and then make sure that you have a plan to get you where you want to go. And I think that's been the problem, is that we've not put the same sort of attention to our epidemic here at home over the last 2 years, and I think we've let our guard down. We don't have the data in many places. We don't have a plan, and we don't have the tools to measure how well we're doing so that we can continue to make progress. We know that what the tools are. It's not surprising. We know a lot about what it takes to prevent the infection, treat people with infection, do a comprehensive response, but we aren't doing it.
Jose, I want to ask you, we use the phrase, what's the takeaway from this? And if you were to sum up what you think someone who may not be following HIV/AIDS closely should take away from listening to this conversation, what would it be?
Well, here in the district, here in D.C., what we're looking at is what the CDC calls a generalized modern epidemic. And what I mean by that is that, you know, in the past, we've always thought of AIDS as something that happens, like, over there. You know, it's gay people, or it's poor people, or it's this, or it's that. It's not something that we think would ever kind of affect us, right? Well, here in D.C., looking at these numbers, to me, the biggest headline was when we say that 7.2% of all residents ages 40 to 49 in D.C., that's nearly 1 out of 10 of every D.C. resident aged 40 to 49 is infected with HIV. 40 to 49 is Michelle and Barack Obama's demographic. So I think that's interesting. And so I think that's how we should think about this disease.
Oh, that's serious food for thought, Jose. Thank you. Jose Antonio Vargas is a reporter with the Washington Post. He's been covering this for some time. And Dr. Helene Gale is president and CEO of CARE. We thank you both.
And the Washington Post has really taken a leadership role on covering AIDS in Washington. I remember back in the 80s, they were definitely doing it. Washington Post, a big newspaper in the United States. We're talking about the current predicament of the newspaper business. And we're asking, what does your morning paper mean to you, and will you miss it?
I read the New York Times in print every day, and I've been reading it for over 50 years, and I think the loss of newspapers is not replaced by the magic machine that we call a computer.
And here's another thought.
The loss of my daily paper means absolutely nothing. Anybody under 40 years old doesn't read a newspaper. Rest in peace.
That's what they're saying in Seattle. The Post Intelligencer is going out of business, at least in its printed version. Will it be able to survive online? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Podcast to go at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. Go ahead and subscribe. Here's your takeaway.
Pakistan is without a doubt the greatest foreign policy challenge facing this administration, which can seem surprising given the fact that, you know, we have the largest majority of our troops right now in Iraq.
Podcast Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times, who is in our agenda segment.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is, of course, The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
We go now to the Office of Human Resources at AIG, where CEO Edward Liddy is getting a real grilling.
So, Mr. Liddy, I want to point out a few items on this otherwise exemplary employee evaluation.
Can't be perfect.
No, guess not. So, this $1 trillion of questionable assets on your books, that's something we're going to need to watch in the future.
Yes, I can explain that. Not proud of that at all, no.
No. Well, don't worry. That's something we want to keep an eye on.
Right, right. Could bring down the whole economy.
This other matter of the...
The fourth quarter thing?
Yeah. $61 billion loss, if I'm not mistaken. That is the largest corporate loss in the history of the world.
The universe, I think. And let me say, a team effort all the way. My team and I work very closely together on these things.
Aha. Uh-huh. Again, something we want to get a smidge more control over going forward.
Going forward.
Yeah, going forward. So, 450 it is.
450?
Yes, that's the bonuses for this year. 450 million, Mr. Liddy. Now that's it, sir. Kick your slap wrists and get back to work.
Yeah. Well, I've learned my lesson. Back to work now.
AIG, what's that spell? Agony? You can't get away with bankrupting the economy and bringing down the entire company. No. You can get a bonus for that on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, March 16th. Economic priorities on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we report on multi-billion dollar scandals and cheats a lot lately. But today, we're going to look at the fascinating psychology of cheating on the everyday scale, plus one man's quest to keep wallets open for charity in tough economic times. All this and much more ahead. But first, these headlines.
Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke striking an optimistic tone last night on 60 Minutes.
We do have a plan. We're working on it. And I do think that we will get it stabilized and we'll see the recession coming to an end probably this year. We'll see recovery beginning next year and it'll pick up steam over time.
One number not likely to improve quickly is unemployment. President Obama hopes new federal moves will help small businesses stay afloat and create jobs. The White House rolls out a stimulus money plan for small business today.
And fallen insurance giant AIG is revealing which outside companies got secret slices of tens of billions in government bailout bucks. AIG came under fire this weekend for paying hundreds of millions of dollars in employee bonuses. Many folks getting bonuses worked on the same risky programs that actually ruined the company. Looking over sees a mass protest in turbulent Pakistan is getting results, John.
Yes, new violence in Pakistan and neighboring Afghanistan. We'll have more about that in a moment. It's time to print your brackets for the office pool. Tournament is set for college basketball's March Madness. Top men's seeds are Connecticut, Pittsburgh, North Carolina, and Louisville. The Dow and S&P are going to open positive this morning in about 30 minutes' time. We're talking about your local paper. Will you miss it if it goes out of business or goes online?
Not everybody has a computer or internet access, so I'm unhappy with the Detroit News and Free Press going to digital.
Join the conversation, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora. New developments this morning in Pakistan. The Pakistani government agreed early this morning to reinstate the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's a stunning concession to the opposition leader, Nawaz Sharif, who was heading towards the capital in a convoy, threatening to stage a mass protest over the issue after he broke free from house arrest at his residence. Joining us for analysis on Zardari's future, Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist and author of Descent into Chaos, The U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Mr. Rashid, now, are these really signs of power shifting on a grand scale?
Yes, certainly. I think this is a major surrender by President Zardari. I think he's lost a lot of credibility, a lot of influence. He took it to such a pitch And so did Nawaz Sharif. Both of them took it to such a pitch that the only way there could be no compromise, the only way this could be resolved was by one side surrendering. And we've got now a much weakened president. His own future is now very much in doubt. And even though there is now an attempt to reconcile the opposition and the government, I think this is going to linger for some time.
When you think about the history of Pakistan and the, between assassinations, military governance, what kind of governance is going on right now with this grappling for power right now? What would you call this?
Well, it's basically a power grab by Nawaz Sharif, which has been resisted by Asif Zardari. But the real crisis is that the two major issues, that is the collapsing economy, which is in a state of total meltdown, and the spread of the Taliban in northern Pakistan and the lack of governance, these issues haven't been addressed yet by this new government that's been in power now almost a year. We haven't seen advances on these issues, which are what is affecting public security and really affecting the public. The public want answers to these questions.
Ahmed Rashid, it appears as though, at the very least, the chief of staff of the army, General Kayani, is going to allow President Zardari in this weakened state to just sort of stumble through. Do you think that the army staying out of this dispute and standing back in the middle of this crisis is a positive thing or not?
Well, I think at one level, certainly the army has not stayed out. It has been very decisive in pushing Zardari to accept the Chief Justice back in power. I think the army has played a very influential behind-the-scenes role. And actually what we are going to see now is that probably the Prime Minister, who comes from the same party as Zardari, the Prime Minister, Yusuf Reza Gilani, is going to be strengthened by the army vis-a-vis Zardari. So we're going to see now the army playing a much more critical role in the domestic fabric of Pakistan, controlling foreign policy through the Prime Minister, controlling domestic policy through the Prime Minister, and isolating and weakening Zardari further. So the army is very much there.
All right. Well, we certainly want to keep up with these developments. Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much. Pakistani journalist and also author of Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan.
Well, it's an interesting takeaway that the army is definitely driving things, even though it looks as though they've stepped back. Listen to this statement by Lawrence Summers, director of the National Economic Council, who spoke over the weekend on ABC's This Week program.
We are a country of law. There are contracts. The government cannot just abrogate contracts. Every legal step possible to limit those bonuses is being taken.
Sounds reasonable. Contract is a contract, right? Except if you're talking about AIG, which is mostly owned by you and me, the American taxpayers, and the millions and millions of bonuses that executives are receiving because of the contracts they have with AIG, that troubled insurance giant, it's not just a question of contracts. It's a question of politics. It's a question of ethics. And it's possibly even a question of law. To talk about how we're to make of the infuriating development of bonuses that have to be paid from the U.S. Treasury to executives at AIG, who some of whom must be responsible for the largest corporate loss in U.S. history, announced for the last quarter, $61 billion, is Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, and author of Predictably Irrational. And quite unpredictably, and just as irrationally, Dan is here in the studio at this early morning hour here in New York. Dan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I never imagined how glamorous radio is until I actually got to step into the studio.
There you go. Kind of reminds you of AIG, huh?
This is because we have, you know, the dancers on one side, the orchestra pit on the other. It's, you know, we try not to overuse them.
That's right.
How are we to think about this business of, first of all, there's the idea of contract law. Okay, there are contracts and you have to honor them no matter how awful it seems to pay the money to AIG executives versus a time of crisis, economic necessity, the idea that, you know, all rules are off in this crisis, as we've been hearing over and over again.
So one thing is there's a question of is it really the legal issue? So I'm sure they have contracts and they have to pay them. But, for example, they could decide to disassemble AIG tomorrow and then they don't have any responsibility to pay anything. And then they could reassemble it the next day. So, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of flexibility in how these contracts really would hurt or would carry it out. The real issue is does the government understand the trust that is going to be loss under over these bonuses? You know, if you look at these things, you say, well, it's only a few million dollars. I mean, what's the big deal? We're paying billions of dollars. This is a drop in the bucket. Why should anybody care? And the fact is that economically we shouldn't care. I mean, there's such a huge loss over these things that a few million dollars here and there don't matter. The reason we care, though, is that it's an outrage. So in some sense,
do the math. It's trivial, but you begin to calculate it in terms of confidence and a sense of credibility of both the government and these corporate leaders. Then it's a whole different calculation.
That's right. And I think that they don't understand. Actually, many of the actions of the government tell us that I think they don't understand how loss of trust is actually fueling this recession and economic meltdown and how important it is to regain trust. I mean, everything we're doing is to inject liquidity into the market. And I think the counterpart of liquidity is the public trust in the banking system and in the government.
If you trust, you'll spend your money or you'll lend your money. If you're afraid, you'll hold on to it, you'll save it. And banks are doing this and consumers are doing this. And confidence is all about whether you do one or the other.
That's right. Exactly. Hmm.
It strikes me that one of the things we've been able to talk about on the show is how many of the questions people have are in a vacuum of knowledge. People who see the stock market go up and down and who feel an emotional response don't necessarily have a rational context for those responses. So what do you do when you're trying to deliver information about whether something like the payments from AIG are terrible and bad, not just on a sort of sting level, but on a major level to the economy, to people who, you know, including myself sometimes, who don't know economic issues in depth?
So, you know, the truth is that this recession has shown us that nobody understands economic issues, right? I mean, very quickly before this recession started, nobody had any clue, vast majority of people had no clue what was going on. So we have a huge problem with understanding in general. And I think the big issue would be to come and say, look, this is the problem that we have here, and try and explain it in general, plain English to the public. Instead, we've done the opposite. We've come up, if you think about Paulson's statements at the first bailout, of saying, you know, trust me, I need to buy these toxic assets, and then not doing anything in this regard, and not buying any toxic assets and spending $350 billion on something else.
And then, Dan, you have Ben Bernanke, who just expresses this kind of outrage and frustration last night on 60 Minutes. Listen to this.
Of all the events and all the things we've done in the last 18 months, the single one that makes me the angriest, that gives me the most angst, is the intervention with AIG. Here was a company that made all kinds of unconscionable bets. Then when those bets went wrong, we had a situation where the failure of that company would have brought down the financial system.
He's got angst, and this is a giant crisis. Can't they declare martial law or eminent domain? I mean, isn't there a doctrine that says, okay, new rules, folks?
I'm sure they could. And I think they could also apply to the humanity of the people who are getting these bonuses, right? They could say to them, look, legally, we have to give you the bonuses. Let's say they have to do it. But you know what? If you want to keep your job, give 70% of this
right
back to
That's
charity.
Good. That's good. Or give them counterfeit bills that are marked, and so people will not honor them. So actually, if you go up and try to buy a yacht or something, they go, oh, this is AIG bonus money. Sorry, we don't accept that here. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, you can do all the math you want, but confidence in the economy is about ethics and morality. More with Dan Ariely coming right up. We're talking about local newspapers. Rita Casey from Detroit writes on our website, our morning papers are disappearing here in Detroit to be replaced mostly by the internet. Will we still have high-quality local reporting? Will there be the will to investigate stories that take weeks and months to develop? Or will our reporting be a matter of national news services plus a few items written by stringers? Join the conversation on the future of newspapers in your community. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Sure. When there's a big financial swindle, a scandal, or some sort of corruption, it's in the headlines, and it's the number of zeros behind it that's right at the top. Bernie Madoff, $65 billion. There's $100,000 Tom Daschle didn't pay in taxes. But counting the zeros probably isn't the best way of figuring out the significance of various levels of cheating, particularly if you're talking about the financial sector. With us still is Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational. Dan says that it's the small impulse of dishonesty, all those small impulses that are more destructive than the huge number of zeros behind a single financial scandal like Bernie Madoff or those bonuses at AIG. Dan, tell us more about your findings.
Here is what we basically did. We tempted people to cheat. We gave some people a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems that everybody could solve, and we gave them 5 minutes, not enough time to solve them all. When the 5 minutes were over, we asked them to count how many they got correct, to give us the sheet, and we paid them $1 per question. Turns out people solve 4 problems in 5 minutes. We paid them $4. Other people, we gave them a chance to cheat. We gave them the same sheet. When the 5 minutes were over, we said, please shred your piece of paper, eliminate all evidence, and tell us how many questions you got correctly. Now the average went up to 7. Now these people did not become smarter, they just cheated. But interestingly enough, from about 5,000 or 6,000 people we tested so far, we had only a handful that cheated a lot, that basically claimed they've solved a lot of it. We had thousands of people that cheated just a little bit.
So the issue of figuring out the dynamic of the Madoff, you know, high-value cheater who's doing it all the time versus the economic value of a lot of people doing a little bit of cheating, that's what you're trying to do here.
That's right. And if you think about me as an economy, I've lost about $100 to the high cheaters, and I lost thousands of dollars to all the people who cheated just by a little bit.
So that would be the people who cheated a lot are the Madoffs, okay?
Yes.
But the people who cheated a little bit are the ones who made maybe bad risks on subprime mortgages, the people who fudged the data on their mortgage application, that sort of thing.
That's right. And actually what we find is that the people who cheat just a little bit, which is the majority, basically all of us, there are things that make us able to cheat a bit more and things that make us cheat a little less. And it's not what you think. Usually people think it's about the economic incentive. How much money do I stand to gain? Turns out we pay people 10 cents, 50 cents, $1, $2, $5, $10 per correct question. Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Still, a lot of people cheat just a little bit. We change the probability of catching them. They shred half the sheet, the whole sheet. They paid themselves from a ball of money. Doesn't matter. What matters is what people feel is okay. We basically want to look at the mirror and feel good about ourselves. And at the same time, we want to benefit from cheating. I call this the individual fudge factor. And the question is, what changes this fudge factor? So, for example, when we get people to try and recall the Ten Commandments, and in our sample of college students, nobody could recall the Ten Commandments.
Of course.
Cheating goes away.
Cheating goes away?
It goes away.
So you simply say to them, all
please,
right, what's right and wrong? Remind them of what is right and wrong. Cheating is wrong, and the cheating goes away.
We don't remind them. They remind themselves. Even when we get self-declared atheists to swear on the Bible, they stop cheating. So that's about decreasing the fudge factor. But even more disturbing, there's a question of what increases the fudge factor. And there are two important topics here. One is when people cheat not for money, but for something that is different. When they finish the test and they come to us and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems. Give me X tokens. We pay them in tokens, and then they walk 12 feet to the side and change a token for a dollar. Cheating doubles. Now think about it. How would you feel about taking a pencil from work versus taking 10 cents from a petty cash box? They feel very, very different.
So that's why credit default swaps seem so easy. But if it was actual cash, people might be disincentivized.
That's right. And I feel in some sense cash brings people back to their honesty, where all of these things that are so removed from cash makes it much more easy for people to justify and tell themselves stories. So basically, if you think about Wall Street, we paid people a lot of money to look at mortgage-backed securities is a good deal. Imagine somebody paid you $10 million, John, if you could see them as a good deal. You would be able to see them
I
as a good deal.
I probably would figure out how to see them as a good deal. Yeah.
If the way to view them was very flexible and there were multiple steps removed for money, that will help as well. But the final step, and actually what worries me about Madoff, is the final experiment we did. And here is the setup. We prepaid everybody. So if you were in the experiment, you would get an envelope with $10 in upfront. And we hired an acting student to stand up 30 seconds into the experiment and said, Mr. Experiment, I solved everything. What do I do next? The experiment said, you solved everything. Go home. So now we have a Madoff kind of a person who basically stole in an egregious way all the money. And the question is, what will happen to everybody else in the experiment who was sitting in the room?
And?
What do you think?
I don't know.
Ran for the hills with the dollar bills.
So you think they cheated more?
They didn't finish, right?
Well, so here's what happened. It turns out it depended on what kind of sweatshirt that guy was wearing. We ran this experiment at Carnegie Mellon. All the students were Carnegie Mellon students. When the student who was cheating was wearing a Carnegie Mellon sweatshirt, he was part of the group, cheating went up.
Wow.
But when he was wearing a University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt, you know, it's kind of a rivaling university, cheating actually went down. And I think this is actually an important lesson for Madoff. It turns out that when people who are in the in-group are part of our social group cheat, we find it more morally acceptable to cheat a bit more even ourselves.
The Washington Club, the Washington Old Boys Network, that's how it works. They're all wearing the same T-shirt. They're all cheating or flexibly sort of fudging. And, you know, it's almost impossible to correct a system like that.
That's right. And from that perspective, we can think about whether the Madoff scandal is just kind of chapter one and whether his legacy will be that he is basically creating a new standard for what the people in his in-group are going to deem acceptable in terms of cheating from now on.
The Wall Street Old Boys Network. We're going to say nothing of the fact that we're not even looking at the small bits of cheating in the same way that we're prosecuting the Madoffs of the world. Dan Ariely, James B. Duke, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational. Fascinating discussion behind the science of cheating. And now more headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Later this morning, President Obama and his economic team will announce a broad package aimed at helping the nation's struggling small businesses. The proposed package plan includes lending fee cuts and a new government loan aid, and the money comes from the stimulus package. Fed Chief Ben Bernanke says that the recession may be over by the end of the year, but he also says this rosy prediction can only become reality if the government succeeds in jump-starting lending and fixing the financial system. Alaska's Mount Redoubt volcano is rumbling again. The area is now under orange alert, and that's the stage just before a volcano blows. Scientists say that an eruption doesn't seem likely to happen right away, but conditions are changing fast. Let's look at news making headlines this morning.
Government says industrial production dropped for the fourth straight time to a new record low. That's just out. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
25 years he's worked at the paper. Man's here to take him downstairs. And I'm sorry, Mr. Jones. It's time.
It's time. Ben Folds, who can always fold a song into a weeper, talking about a newspaper man getting laid off after 25 years. It's not so far from reality. I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer has been around longer than Washington itself has been a state. It printed its last issue last week, and let's emphasize printed. This week, the people of Seattle will find out if the paper will survive in online-only form, and the Hearst Corporation is pondering whether to do that. Folks call it the PI locally. It's the latest casualty in a newspaper bloodbath with no end in sight. Jacqueline Banaschinski holds the night chair in editing at the Missouri School of Journalism. She worked at the Seattle Times, the rival to the PI, for 8 years, and worked at two papers in Minneapolis-St. Paul that are both on a short list of papers in trouble. Jacqueline, it's great to have you with us. And let's start with a little bit about public opinion. The Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, a great research center, just did a survey, and 42% of people said they wouldn't miss their local paper if it closed. First of all, do you believe them when they say that?
Well, good morning, Farai. It's nice to be here. You can look at those numbers another way, in other ways, and there was a big debate here at Missouri among my research colleagues about the interpretation of those numbers. And they said one way to read them is that 74% of people said that they would miss aspects of their newspaper, maybe not the print newspaper itself, but certainly the journalism it provides.
So that still leaves a sizable number, and one might argue a tipping point of non-paying, mm-hmm. Non-subscribing, non-newsstand-buying folks. What's bad about a newspaper closing? Is it really bad?
Well, you know, the debate has gotten focused around saving the newspaper. I think the debate needs to be about saving journalism. And saving journalism that is represented by the traditional mainstream newspapers. What's at risk is more than newspapers and newspaper jobs. What's at risk is the foundations of traditional journalism, which are the foundations of how we keep our democracy going.
So you have groups now that are nonprofits that are trying to take some of this territory. Mm-hmm. We sometimes partner with ProPublica, which is an investigative reporting group. There are a lot of other nonprofits that, you know, when enterprise reporting is something we talk about in the business, which is where you actually have to do a lot of work and not just talk out of your rusty dusty. So, you know, it's pretty easy to reprint things that just sort of pop into your mind. But when you have to hit the streets or you have to hit the files and, you know, dig through information, it takes a lot of time and it's expensive. So are nonprofit groups going to replace or at least supplement what news organizations aren't really willing to pay for at this point?
Well, there's the big question, right? And everybody is scrambling to answer that question now. What's the new business model? There is no reigning wisdom. And the closest anybody's coming right now is to say that there are going to have to be multiple business models, little experiments here and there, while we figure out what in this revolution, and this is a revolution, how we figure out what is the financial underpinning of something that I think we need as much as we need any other economic force in society. I think newspapers, journalism, let's say journalism, not newspapers, are as important or more important to what we do than anything else we're debating right now in this economy. So will nonprofits be part of the solution? I expect so. Will they be a stopgap to something more solid and universal in the future? I don't know. If I did, I wouldn't have to worry about my own job, right?
Well, let's talk about this issue of community, which I think is independent of journalism and business models. And I want to take you back, Jackie, to the days you were wandering around Eugene, Oregon, with me at the beginning of our careers, or at least my career. There was a quality of localism in the reporting of a paper like the Eugene Register Guard, where everybody turned to the Guard for its opinion, for its sense of the local politics, for what was going on in the economy, for where to get a good meal, for, you know, the lowest price of gasoline. It seems like newspapers have a very difficult time recreating that sense of localism when there are so many competitors online for search and advertising and you know, sort of columns and blogs that give that localism. How do you recreate that? It's almost independent of journalism.
Well, it is, John, independent of journalism in the traditional ways we supply journalism. You know, what people paid for primarily was delivery, and now they can get delivery by flipping on their computer switch. The other thing that's happened is localism, I think, has to be redefined, and the Internet is part of that, too. Community is no longer defined primarily or exclusively geographically. Community is defined by interests, by passions. What is local anymore? Local to me is what's going on with the economy, and that's happening in Washington, D.C., and that's happening on Wall Street. So I don't think we can try to solve this. I don't think the answers come by asking the same questions. I think the questions have to change.
I'm sure that this sentiment will be familiar to you. This is a blogger for the PI.
I write a would-be on-life blog for the PI. I'm what's called a citizen journalist, and hopefully our voices will still be there. But it's just not going to be the same to not have that morning latte with the morning PI every day of the week. So farewell to the Seattle PI.
Jackie, just give us a quick blip on what citizen journalists can and can't do in a potentially newspaperless world.
Volunteer journalists can do a lot, and they always have been when we've been at our best as professional journalists, a big part of our equation. When I was a young reporter in Duluth, Minnesota, part of my job was to call 50 people in the tri-state region, housewives and cafe owners and school principals, who would read the church bulletins to me and read to me what was on their school reports and read their little local weeklies. And that's how I would gather up string for my news. That function is more important and more possible than ever.
Right.
But you can't replace the person who goes and sits at the sewer commission meeting for 4 hours or who watchdogs a story that's going to cost months and thousands of dollars. You can't ask people to do that for free.
Yeah, we're definitely going to be keeping track of this. This is our business, and it's a concern for so many people. Jacqueline Bashinsky holds the night chair in editing at the Missouri School of Journalism. Thank you, and straight on to Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question for you, Fry. What is a rusty dusty? We were debating it in the newsroom.
Oh, yeah, right.
Quickly.
It's what you sit on.
Okay, thank you. Your bottom, your derriere.
Right.
Gluteus maximus, thank you very much. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The government says that the nation's industrial output fell for the fourth straight month in February, with the factory operating rate dropping to the lowest level in more than half a century of record keeping. The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, is promising to see if anything can be done about the big executive bonuses at the bailed-out insurance giant AIG. Representative Barney Frank was speaking on NBC's Today Show this morning. And the former Vice President, Dick Cheney, told CNN yesterday that his ex-chief of staff, Scooter Libby, deserved to be pardoned by the then-President Bush. That's a good headlines making news this morning.
Is there a rusty, dusty call? Is that possible? Thank you, Pam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Salvadorians turned out in large numbers yesterday in a tense election. It turned power over to the leftist party of the country's former guerrillas. This marks a change of two decades of right-wing party rule, 17 years after peace accords ended El Salvador's brutal civil war. Sarah Yana is Latin American Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. And Sarah, put this into context for us. I mean, there are many Salvadorians in the U.S. who came here in part because of the violence. Is the country now at a place of reconciliation where this marks a closing of a chapter?
Well, it was a very polarized race, but people are saying this is a point of political maturation. They are definitely putting something behind them, and they're voting for change. They were not voting necessarily on ideological lines. The ruling party had been in power for 20 years, and people are voting on concerns about the economy and on crime.
So when you say that it was a tough election or that there were some strains, how was the election carried out in terms of campaign messaging?
Well, one of the major themes here is that the ruling party really tried to paint the leftists as allies of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. So you're going around San Salvador, and there are billboards of the leftist candidate, Mauricio Funes, who actually comes from outside the leftist camp, but he's photoed with Hugo Chavez all over the city.
I was curious. There was one article that talked about Mr. Funes using the words safe change. It's like, you know, change is everywhere. All politicians are using the phrase change. But what does safe change mean? It's, I guess, in part because of the past of the country that the word safe was added to change?
Exactly. He was just trying to fight back against the message that voting in the party of, you know, former Marxist guerrillas does not mean a return to the war. You know, the war ended in 1992, and I think that this is a sign that people are putting that behind them, but it's in the undercurrent of every conversation here. And, you know, you talk to people, and they do talk about former communists and whether this means that, you know, El Salvador is going too far to the left. So he was just trying to fight and say, this is a change, but it's not a change back to the Cold War. This is a new change for the country.
What do religious affiliations tell us about how people voted?
Well, one of the interesting things in this race was that the evangelical vote was key. Evangelicals comprise about 30% of the population. And in El Salvador, they have tended to vote on the right. But this race showed us that about 60% were voting for the left, and it was a huge change here.
And are any of these Salvadorians I mentioned who've come to the States, did any of them participate in the election?
Yes, they say thousands of them came back for the race. So, it was a huge part. I mean, up to a third of this country lives abroad, and they send remittances that are hugely important to the economy, about 20%. So they were following the race from the U.S., and many of them returned to participate.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much. That was Sarah Yana, Latin American Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora. All this morning, we're asking you about your local newspaper. We want to know, what does your morning paper mean to you? Are you going to miss it?
If people really did miss their newspapers or really care about the newspaper, then the newspaper wouldn't be in such a problem. There's a fundamental distrust of the press in this country that is misguided, but unfortunately very real.
All right. You can have your say. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Does your morning paper mean a lot to you? Or are you trying to save it? Or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Femi OK has the news.
Thank you very much. At 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A new report shows that American factory output sank for the fourth straight month, hitting a record low. Production dropped by 1.4%. February's numbers are the lowest in more than half a century of record-keeping. The insurance giant AIG is naming names. The company released a list of financial institutions that benefited from the company's multiple government bailouts. AIG used government's funds to make payments of nearly $100 billion to outside firms. In international news, the OPEC cartel says it will not cut oil production. It says that the economic downturn influenced their decision. Abdullah Salam El-Badri is the OPEC Secretary General, and in a news conference, he hopes that the global demand for oil will not fall below the current levels.
We think the 1 million barrel a day less in demand year on year, maybe this is the bottom, but our mind is not set for positive, it's set for negative, unfortunately.
And OPEC will meet again in late May. That's a look at news making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So he's put his ethical and philosophical approach to discussions of disability and also the eating of meat and the killing of animals for the food supply. Now, Princeton professor and bioethicist Peter Singer has a new book called The Life You Can Save. It's about the capacity, the very real capacity, in his view, of human beings in the civilized world to, in fact, end extreme world poverty. In church congregations around the world, they refer to the Millennium Agenda of Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, which calls for the ending of extreme poverty in our lifetime. Peter Singer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
And your book, The Life You Can Save, suggests that it is possible for us to take actual concrete steps, both individually and in communities, that will have the effect of ending extreme poverty. Why do you think that is the case?
Because if you look at the amount of wealth we have and you suggest realistic scales for donation, which I do in the book, we could produce sums that are greatly in excess of what Jeffrey Sachs, for example, calculates is needed to meet the Millennium Development Goals. Now, that only halves the proportion of the world's people living in extreme poverty. But I think from then we could continue to go further. Now, I'm not saying that there'll be no poverty at all, no extreme poverty. Obviously, there will be pockets of it here or there. There'll be particular repressive governments where we can't really help, or civil wars. But I don't think there have to be a billion people living in extreme poverty throughout the world. I think we can stop that if we want to.
And in general, the mechanism for this is a huge-scale wealth transfer from the wealthy in the world, who you say are more numerous than ever before, just like the number of people in extreme poverty, to the people in extreme poverty, and that should be accomplished by essentially a voluntary system of tithing appealing to people's morality, and that is possibly going to be more effective than any sort of imposed wealth transfer. And we argue about that a lot in American politics.
Yes, but I think in the United States, at least, this may not be true for every country. Our government foreign aid program has not been nearly as effective dollar for dollar as the amounts that go through NGOs. And so that's why I think that we should be increasing this. Now, if I could just correct one thing, I'm not suggesting tithing for everyone. I have a scale, which is in the book and also on my website, which has the same title as the book, thelifeyoucansave.com. And it starts at 1%. In fact, for 90% of Americans, I'm suggesting just a 1% donation. And only when you get into the top 10% of U.S. taxpayers does it start rising towards tithing. So that's what's surprising in a way, that we don't have to give so much. You know, you talk about it as a big wealth transfer, but it's not as a percentage of our wealth, it's not so much. It is a big increase on the amount of foreign aid we're giving now, because that's actually really quite tiny.
Peter, what about the question of accountability? I mean, here in the U.S., we've had, in addition to the financial scandals, we've also had questions about what charitable organizations do in certain cases. Is the money being spent well? Is it being spent badly? You know, there are ratios you can look at to see how much of the money is actually going to direct action. But I'm not sure how many people who make donations do that, particularly, for example, a lot of wealth is tithed through religious organizations, and people there have a very personal standpoint on who they're giving to. So even if you get people to tithe or to give, how can you be accountable for where that money goes?
Well, I think we do need to give to effective organizations, and we need to have more public information about which are effective. And it's not just about the percentage of their money that goes through administration, because an effective organization needs to spend something on administration. And sometimes cutting back too much on administration can make you less effective at making sure that your money is going to the right projects. But we are starting to get places where people can have a look at that. There's a website I refer to called givewell.net, where people can look at some assessment of some of the more effective organizations. And we need more of that. We need that to be out there in public. We need to be talking about which organizations are really doing the best job so that people can know where to give.
Isn't there a bit of an illusion at work here in the sense that if you do the math slowly, 1% donation doesn't seem like a lot, and if you have the sliding scale as you have in the book and on the website, the sacrifices do seem minimal individual to individual. But certainly you're not saying that essentially painless sacrifice is all that's required by the people in the developed world to end world poverty, something that we've never even gotten close to in all of world history.
I am saying that the wealth of the affluent world is such that it would not really be a huge sacrifice. I mean, I don't think we would miss it. And for many people, perhaps most, I think we would find a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction with what we're doing that was much more important than the fact that, you know, we're giving up the second flat-screen TV for the bedroom or whatever it might be that we don't buy now.
Do you have two flat-screen TVs?
I actually don't have any TVs.
Any TVs, I see. Here's a question. You've gotten some controversial criticism on the part of people with disabilities for positing in some of your earlier work that there was a point beneath which a human being was so disabled that they could not expect to live anything like a satisfying life, and that would possibly justify their elimination by their parents, either in the form of some sort of euthanizing procedure, not necessarily after they were born, but possibly in vitro. Is it conceivable you could draw the same argument for people in extreme poverty whose lives are below some threshold where they couldn't possibly have a fulfilling life? And I'm wondering why you didn't draw it there.
Well, I didn't actually draw a line quite like that with people with disabilities either. What I did was I suggested that parents, in consultation with healthcare professionals, their doctors, should sometimes be able to make a decision that it was better that that infant should die. If there were parents living in extreme poverty who felt that they could not help their child, that their child was simply going to starve, maybe euthanasia could be conceivable, but generally, that's not what parents in extreme poverty want. They want to help their child. They want to get help so their children can live.
Just briefly, there is a woman who's being called the anti-Bono for a book called Dead Aid that argues that it's Western aid and the celebrity culture of Western aid and, you know, even books like yours that are they're throwing off the path to self-sufficiency. What do you think of that?
She's actually arguing against government and World Bank aid. If you take a look within the first few pages, she says that she's not really addressing aid through non-government agencies. So I think in a way she's agreeing with me that they're more effective. I do agree with her point that we must avoid making people dependent on aid. We have to have smart aid which helps people to become independent and sustainable.
Well, the idea of smart aid is what the book The Life You Can Save is all about. There's a website called thelifeyoucansave.com. Peter Singer is the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. Thank you, Professor.
And we're talking about the fate of newspapers this morning. Here's your takeaway.
What's at risk is more than newspapers and newspaper jobs. What's at risk is the foundations of traditional journalism, which are the foundations of how we keep our democracy going.
That was Jacqueline Banaschinski from the University of Missouri with our takeaway. And this morning we want to know if you think newspapers should be saved. What does your morning paper mean to you? Can you imagine a world without that accompanying your breakfast? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Plenty of our listeners apparently can imagine it. One was saying that the media can't be trusted, so let the newspapers go away. Others were saying, I can't imagine my life without it, and where will the reporting go?
Yeah, well, the reporting is right here on The Takeaway. And now there's a podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes.
Yes, go back, listen to Jackie Banaschinski, see what you think, and call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.